The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Craftsman Days are here at Lowe's with big savings on the tools you need. Right now, get a free select tool when you buy the Craftsman V20 2-Pack Battery Kit. Whether it's the backyard, the bathroom, or beyond, Craftsman has the tools to help you power through and get the project done right. Because DIYing is unpredictable, but your tools shouldn't be. Shop Craftsman at Lowe's today. Valid through 7-9 while supplies last. Selection varies by location. Maximum initial battery voltage measured without a workload is 20 volts. Nominal voltage is 18.
Fundamentally, gender ideology suggests that men are more oppressed or more vulnerable than women just on the basis of their own say-so. It supersedes reality. It supersedes biology. It basically prioritizes men's feelings over women's reality. And when you have people believing that that is the case or that that is true, it's more offensive, let's say, to hurt a man's feelings or to say no to a man even than the very real threat of male violence against women.
Hello, welcome back to the Brendan O'Neill Show with me, Brendan O'Neill, and my special guest this week, Genevieve Gluck. Genevieve, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much for having me back. It's a pleasure to talk with you, Brendan.
It's great to have you back on. It's been a while since we last spoke. We last spoke about a year or so ago, maybe longer than that, in fact. And we talked in detail about the amazing work you guys do at Redux Magazine, which I think is the go-to magazine for anyone who wants to understand just how dangerous the trans ideology in particular can be for women and for children. And we discussed all the work you guys are doing there. And I guess I want to start off this new discussion with a broader kind of question, which is just to ask you how you think things have changed since you and I last spoke. Because it does seem to me that on this issue, it's sometimes a case of one step forward, but maybe two steps back. You know, we've had some good developments. There's been the CAS review. There are now more gender critical voices. We've seen women in the UK having their right to speak out on this issue being defended in law. So there have been some positive developments, but of course, the ideology itself still has a stranglehold on numerous institutions. So where do you see things? How do you see things at the moment? Is it good? Is it bad? How is it?
I think the pushback is just starting now. And I think that people are starting to become aware of the safeguarding issues that are imposed by gender ideology. But also in particular, in the United States, at least, there's been a lot of attention on sports with advocates like Riley Gaines, who are talking about the issue of men in sports and how that's dangerous to women and girls. And so I think that people are coming to an awareness of this through things like sports, which it's not really controversial, is it? It's pretty obvious when you see a much larger man on a woman's team, like in the case of Leah Thomas. There's not a whole lot of question about what's going on there, which is great. But I am concerned that the topic itself might be used as a wedge issue. In fact, I already think it is being used as an issue to shoehorn in some other ideas. For example, using it as a vehicle to bring in other concepts more as a political tool rather than sitting back and analyzing what's going on. But on one positive front, at least in the US, people are becoming more aware of institutions like WPATH and starting to criticize what it is they've been up to for these past several decades.
That's really interesting observation. And I guess I'd like to ask you why you think it is that something like sports is an issue that people can rally around. I mean, as you say, when they see a 6'4" bloke masquerading as a woman and often taking medals away from women who've trained their whole lives, that is going to offend the normal, decent person. But why do you think it's those kinds of issues that have become the flashpoint issues rather than, say, I don't know, the intrusion of men into rape crisis centres or the prescription of puberty blockers to kids. Why do you think it's issues like sports that have touched people much more strikingly on this issue?
Well, the safety concern, but as you pointed out, you can see the physical difference between men and women in that case. Like during the Paris Olympics, the controversy around Amin Khalif and Lin Yuting. Now, people have questioned whether or not they are actually perhaps DSD, a difference of sexual development, but they did fail a chromosomal test, which indicates they are in fact male. And then we saw that they won clean sweep every single match, 5-0 against the female opponents. It was quite a striking thing to see on TV, to see men in the Olympics in boxing beating women. So I do think that that is a very clear visual for people to understand the problem here.
Okay, so I want to do something that I did with you last time as well, which is just to ask you about a couple of stories on Redux. I mean, Redux is, I think, a must-read magazine for anyone who wants to understand not only why this issue is an issue of concern, but also just the crazier expressions of it, the more destructive expressions of it in everyday life. So I just want to ask you about a couple of stories that you guys have published recently. The first one is about the Danish woman who is being sued for misgendering a trans activist and a sissy fetishist. So this is a man who masquerades as a woman, claims to be a woman, is also a sissy fetishist, which maybe for listeners who don't know, maybe you could explain what exactly that is. And a Danish woman is being sued for harassment and so on for misgendering him. Could you tell us a bit more about that story and what you think it tells us about, I guess, the question of freedom of speech on this issue?
Right. So earlier this year, a Danish woman named Lotte Ingerslev, she writes a blog and she's criticizing gender identity in her blog. And earlier this year, I think it was in March, she had documented this long blog post about a man using the name Nadia Jacobson, who he identifies as transgender, and he has been involved in working on inclusivity policies for the Danish Football Association, meaning that under these new inclusive guidelines, men would be allowed into women's locker rooms and changing rooms. And so she was concerned about this because she had accidentally stumbled across the pornography that he was publishing online of himself. Now, I want to explain this particular genre in the best way that I can without being too vulgar. So sissy porn revolves around the notion of a man being forcibly feminized or forced to turn into a woman by way of things such as lingerie or makeup or sexual penetration. In this type of pornography, the belief is that being penetrated makes a man into a woman. So it's associated with the eroticization of humiliation and degradation. In particular, it associates women with something that is humiliating and not human, less than human. So he had been taking photos of himself and videos as well, recording videos of himself of a pornographic nature. And so Lotte was basically questioning why it is that a man like this is being an advisor for inclusivity guidelines for the Danish Football Union. And almost immediately, I believe it was the very next day, the man who, like I said, uses the name Nadia Jacobson online got some of his friends and trans activists to rally around this issue. They immediately tried to have her blog pulled, the entirety of it, not just the post, to have her website taken down, shut down with a group that they have together called Trans Tech. And then they began to harass her and dox her. So one of his friends online actually was able to get her address and a satellite image of her home, and they were sharing online, which is quite intimidating and threatening. And but the problem here is that they're not being held to account for their behavior. Rather, she is the one who's being charged with what amounts to about $14,000 USD for misgendering. Supposedly calling him a man is a worse insult than the harassment and doxing that she was made to endure.
It really is an extraordinary story. And when I was reading it, it reminded me, in fact, of the discussion that we had last time, where we talked in some detail about the work that you have done on porn and the relationship between porn and the trans ideology, the interplay between those two phenomena. And this case really speaks to that. And I did want to ask you, just on this particular case, how common is the sissy fetishist? And I think you're right not to get into too much vulgar detail about what that entails. But how common is the sissy fetishist among trans activists or certain quarters of trans activism? Because as you described it there, it does seem to me that it's a particularly degrading form of pornography, one in which the man is forced to become a woman. And apparently all a woman is a whole, essentially. I mean, that is how these people see it through this pornographic genre. Is there a lot of sissy fetishism in trans activism? What's the relationship there?
When I first started talking about this about 5 years ago, I was mocked for drawing a connection between this genre of pornography and trans activism. But I think that I've been proven correct over time. And one particular example that comes to mind is the American academic Andrea Long Chu, who he uses the name Andrea, his real name is Andrew, and he wrote in detail in an academic paper even that he presented at women's universities in the United States. It was titled, "Did Sissy Porn Make Me Trans?" And he also had published a book called Females through Verso Press a few years back that again discusses his pornography addiction and how that led him to begin to adopt a transgender status or call himself a woman. And in his own words, he says that it reduces women to the barest essentials, i.e. A whole, like as you said. And so he's conflating womanhood with not only the porn genre itself, but with the act of being penetrated. And he uses very explicit language to describe this. And I have written at this point well over 200 news articles. I'm not sure the exact number. And of those, I have repeatedly seen this connection between this genre of pornography and some of the most vociferous types of activists that go after women. There was another case in the Netherlands where a woman was reported to police, and it turned out that that man who reported her to the police for calling him a man was also into this type of pornography. So we have to consider that as well. These men are mobilizing in online communities and sharing this type of pornography. They're all over social media. They're all over Facebook even, which is ironic because you can be censored very easily on Facebook, but they have tons of these types of groups that are dedicated to this type of pornography. And they tend to go online and gamify their addiction, encourage each other to go out in public dressed as women, encourage each other to go into women's spaces and changing rooms. They'll ask for pictures of their excursions and swap them with each other. So it's a type of gamifying of the pornography and taking it out into the real world.
Yeah. And, you know, Andrea Long Chu, who you mentioned there, I mean, he is not a small voice in the trans world. You know, he has a very prominent presence in the trans discussion in the United States and has been garlanded with praise and awards for his writing. So I think you're absolutely right to point out the connection between sissy porn and other forms of porn and the trans ideology more broadly. And I noticed it in Grace Lavery's book as well, in which he describes, he's another trans-identified male, and he describes how porn helped him understand what kind of woman he wanted to become. And he mentions porn films by name. He mentions Edward Penis Hands and other films that he's watched. So just to stick on this for 1 second, that is an area that people need to get more real about. And as you say, you've been writing about this for some time. You were mocked when you raised it, but it does seem increasingly clear that there is something going on with the porn saturation that our society is experiencing and the growth of this new section of society that has this degraded view of what it means to be a woman, and this idea that a man can become a woman simply by clicking his fingers and putting on certain clothes.
Yes, and I do just want to point out that Grace Lavery, who you mentioned, is a professor at UC Berkeley. And in one of his curriculum that he shared online, he had his students look at sissy porn as part of, and he teaches English literature, by the way.
Yeah, it is terrifying, the thought of this person teaching English literature at Berkeley. You know, what has happened to the academy? Okay, one other story I wanted to ask you about before digging down into a few other issues with you. I wanted to ask you about the case of Alex Secker. So this is a trans-identified male in the UK. I mean, the headline to your piece at Redux just grabbed me instantly, because you guys focused on the fact that this is a person who has spoken out previously against having female-only rape centres, and he has now been convicted of rape. And I think he's received a sentence of 6 years or 6.5 years. Speak to us a little bit about this case and what it tells us about just how serious this ideology has become when someone who actively opposes the right of women to associate freely when they've suffered sexual assault, someone like that could then be found guilty of the gravest form of sexual assault.
So Alexander Secker uses the name Lexi Bowen online, and he had been trying to make himself into something of a YouTube influencer on trans issues. So he had been making videos of himself discussing horror films such as Psycho and Silence of the Lambs and such. But he was doing this at the same time that he was also being under investigation for rape. And he's since been convicted, as you mentioned. But in addition to his YouTube channel, he also had several social media accounts, which he used to harass specifically J.K. Rowling, but several people, mostly women, by the way, who were vocally critical of gender identity ideology. In one instance, he had criticized J.K. Rowling for her stance on the Edinburgh Rape Crisis Center. So there was a controversy surrounding this rape crisis center that involved a trans-identified male CEO. And she was commenting on the issues and following as it was going on. And he was criticizing her all along the way and saying things like, trans women are not a threat to women. And here's a convicted, a man who raped a woman, pushing back against women having their own rape crisis centers. I mean, how much more of a direct example do you need than that? It's shocking. And I'm still shocked, even though I've seen multiple cases of men who turned out to be convicted sex offenders harassing women online for their stances on safe spaces and boundaries. He's not the only one. I've written about several at this point, but I think that his case became a little more high profile because of the way in which he was specifically going after J.K. Rowling and politicians.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
Hi, it's Brendan here. I want to let you know some exciting news. My new book is out now. It's called After the Pogrom, 7th of October, Israel and the Crisis of Civilization. And it's available right now from Amazon. I'm really proud of this book. It is an unflinching account of how the West failed the moral test of 7th of October 2023, which of course is the day that Hamas and other militants invaded Israel and unleashed barbarism. The book documents in chilling detail how activists, academics, and others in the West ended up making excuses for Hamas's violence, ended up taking the side of the pogromists against the pogrom's victims, and ended up, in the process, turning their backs on the values of civilization.
The book is fundamentally a call to arms for Western civilization. It makes the case for restoring Enlightenment values and standing with Israel while it's under attack by radical Islamists. I don't know if an author is allowed to describe his own book as essential reading, but I really do think it's essential reading. It's called After the Pogrom, 7th of October, Israel and the Crisis of Civilization, and you can get your copy right now on Amazon. If you want a signed copy of the book, and why wouldn't you, you can get one by donating £50 or more to Spiked. Just go to the Spiked website, look for the donate button, donate today, and you will get a free signed copy of After the Pogrom, 7th of October, Israel and the Crisis of Civilization.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
I mean, the thing I want to say to trans activists and their allies is that if your activism, if your political belief system works to the benefit of rapists, then there's a problem, right? If your ideology is something that lends itself to the interests of men who rape, as it does, clearly does in this case, then that is a very serious problem. And it seems very clear that in the Alex Secker case, he was able to exploit the misogynistic undertones or overtones even of the trans ideology to pursue his own interest in essentially forbidding women from associating freely when they've suffered sexual assault or rape. And then he himself was committing those kinds of crimes. One of the most striking things about his case is that the BBC reported that a trans woman has been jailed for 6.5 years after being found guilty of rape. That was their opening line, right under a photograph of Lexi Secker, also really known as Alex Secker, with a beard, looking like the man that he is, obviously a bloke, and yet still being defined as a trans woman who'd been found guilty of rape. How much of a problem do you think it is that the mainstream media, even the British Broadcasting Corporation, which us Brits are compelled to pay for, how serious is it that the MSN still refers to these men as women, even when they've been convicted of raping women?
Well, I just want to point out that in a different case with another man who identified as transgender, again convicted of rape, he had posted some content online suggesting that he became sexually aroused when people referred to him as a woman. And then when he was in court, they referred to him as Miss and Ma'am. And I think of that when I see things like this, because to go back to the case in Denmark, for example, there's this rage that this man who is taking that woman to court, this rage that she is getting in the way of something that is a sexual fetish for him. And so when we are seeing these men being reported as female, but not only that, referred to as female in the court system, I think it's important for people to understand that perhaps not in every case, because, you know, nothing's ever so black and white, but in many cases, this is sexual for them. And the public is being asked to participate in their fetish publicly.
Yeah, I mean, it is extraordinary. And the fact that women who've experienced the violence of these men will have to listen to those men being referred to in court as women, as she, as her, I mean, it just compounds the thing that they suffered in the first place by then watching the system flatter the delusional identities of the men who raped them or assaulted them. It seems to me an extraordinary cruelty. On this question of crime, I did want to ask you a few questions about an issue that you've been working on in some depth, which I think is one of the most serious issues in relation to the trans ideology, which is the question of female correctional facilities and the way in which men who claim to be women are increasingly being allowed into female prisons and are either committing crimes there or making women feel fearful or doing things that they shouldn't be doing. I want to ask you about the female prison in New Jersey that you've been writing about for a couple of years now, and the problems that have arisen there when men have been placed in that facility. Could you just tell us a bit more about what's going on there?
Sure. So I started looking into the New Jersey women's prison in, about 2 years ago, 2022. It's called Edna Mahan, a correctional facility for women. And so to go back to the beginning, the gender identity policy, which allowed violent men to be transferred into that particular women's prison, was done at the behest of the American Civil Liberties Union, or ACLU. They are behind several of these lawsuits in the United States that allow men to be transferred into women's prisons. So this was no exception. In their court case, they did not name the man initially, but I was able to find out who he was. In the court documents, he's named as Sonia Doe. I discovered he was a man named Daniel Demers, a convicted terrorist who has been since posting online about his fetish for pretending to be a little girl wearing diapers. So he was the test case that allowed for all of the other men to then be transferred in. One of the very first inmates transferred into Edna Mahan is Perry Cerf, and he is serving a 50-year sentence for the brutal murder of a prostituted woman. He drank her blood after he killed her, and he was found driving her car with her driver's license. He had superimposed his own photo, so he was trying to take her identity. So he drank her blood to try to take her identity, and then got her clothes and her car and her ID. And he's in there for 50 years. He's been harassing the women since he got in there. And he's just a case, a perfect example of a case where you have a man who's actually undergone the genital surgery and is still a threat to women, obviously. But since then, several other men have been transferred in the past few years, including two men who were making child pornography, as well as a murderer. So in last year, there was a big controversy after this man, Demi Minor, got two women pregnant at that facility. He was eventually transferred out. He was convicted of murder. So he's now in a men's facility, but only after this made international headlines. The two pregnancies drew so much attention that I feel that the prison officials were forced to do something about it. And they did. So to their credit, they transferred him out. But since then, it's come to light that he had actually been mentoring a man on how to get into the prison for the past year. So in my recent update on that situation, I discovered that Demetrius Minor, or Demi Minor, was teaching another convicted killer on how to get into the women's prison. And they even have the same story that they share, that they had supposedly tried to mutilate their genitals. I'm skeptical of anything that they say. I've not seen any documentation of that, so I'll say that. But he was, in fact, transferred in recently. And I have spoken with these women for the past 2 years. They're very frustrated. They say it's like a dark joke. They feel that no one cares about their safety. A woman has been violently battered in that prison by a man for refusing his sexual advances. And I wonder, you know, what the future is going to hold on this issue, because I do think that the awareness is starting to be, that the issue is being heard, that people are becoming more aware of it. But I feel that perhaps more than sports, this should be the issue to really help people understand the level of danger that's involved. These are violent killers. These are rapists and killers being in a cell with a captive population of potential victims. And so I just hope that, like the sports issue, that this will be the issue that can help people to really see the danger that's involved in this belief system.
I mean, even I've read your pieces on the Edna Mahan facility in New Jersey, and I know the details of them, but just listening to you describe them there, I mean, it is so shocking and so galling that this can happen in a supposedly civilized society in the 21st century, where you have men who murdered women, battered women, drank women's blood, were engaged in child pornography and so on, being put in a women's prison, in a facility with women, many of whom will be vulnerable women, who have the right to expect to only be placed with other women if they're going to be incarcerated, not with men. I mean, how does this happen? I guess, who knows the answer to that question, but maybe you have some suggestions, because we've watched similar developments in the UK. There was the Isla Bryson case in Scotland, which made international headlines as well, where a man who had raped women was temporarily put in a women's prison, and then that was resolved. There was also the Barbie Kardashian case in Ireland. I know that you guys at Redux have done an update on that case recently, because he is now back in court on suspicion of threatening to rape and kill women when he was put in a female prison. To me, this just looks like a form of social psychosis, that when society can put violent men who are violent against women in prisons with women, that to me suggests that society has lost the plot. What is your explanation for a society that can do something as depraved as that?
Fundamentally, gender ideology suggests that men are more oppressed or more vulnerable than women just on the basis of their own say-so. It supersedes reality. It supersedes biology. It basically, to put a point on it, it prioritizes men's feelings over women's reality. And when you have people believing that that is the case, or that that is true, then these are the inevitable results of that kind of belief system, where it's more offensive, let's say, to hurt a man's feelings, or to say no to a man, even not even necessarily hurt his feelings, but just to say no, is somehow worse than the threat, the very real threat of male violence against women. I hesitated to say this, but it feels like terrorism. It really feels like a kind of terrorism. And I want to go back to the pornography aspect, because I think that there is something going on here that's connected to this, where a man's feelings, or a man's fetish even, becomes more important than a woman's boundaries. Women are having their boundaries trampled over every which way. And I see a connection to that with the boundary violations that are involved within pornography.
Do you think there is, the other thing that strikes me about this issue in particular, the prisons question, and just the deranged things that are happening in some women's prisons, do you think there's a class element to this as well? Because I'm often struck by, it does seem to me that mainstream feminism, or I don't know, bourgeois feminism, I don't know what the right description for it is, but there is a strand of feminism that seems to concern itself with, I guess, relatively minor questions. So, for example, there's a group of feminists in Britain at the moment who've been fighting for their right to go into the Garrick Club. So the Garrick Club is a men-only club. It's for incredibly privileged men, high court judges, princes, actors, all sorts of people who live in worlds that the rest of us have no understanding of. And it's men only. It's been around for a very long time. And these feminists are fighting for their right to go in there. And they're often the very same kind of feminists who would never say anything about the New Jersey prison that you've been writing about, and in fact would avoid the issue like the plague. Or I guess if they were confronted and asked a question about it, they might very well support the right of men to identify as women, and therefore to be placed in the women's estate if they ever end up in jail. It's almost dystopian, where you have a certain layer of feminism that is fighting for, I guess, a form of self-enrichment, or the right to enjoy the exact same privileges as men, as privileged men, while ignoring some of the most vulnerable women in society, many of whom are poor or certainly working class if they end up in prison. How do you explain that, the unwillingness, I guess, of influential feminists to grapple with an issue as serious as violent men being placed in close proximity with vulnerable women.
I think there's a degree of cowardice involved, but there's also performativity. So if you can do an action that will be photographed or video or recorded, and if you can share it easily online as a type of way of making yourself look virtuous, then I think that that is going to be more appealing to some people than doing the hard work of actually looking at things like court documents. At Redux, we have to purchase and read many, many lengthy court documents that involve depictions of horrific things. And it's not easy and it's not fun. And it's certainly not something that you can easily do on a video and share it online. So if your politics then become centered totally around performativity and how many shares you're going to get online, then it's naturally going to shape your behavior into more performative and less meaningful actions. I think it's lazy. I think it's cowardice. I think it's, for want of a better word, what people say virtue signaling is. It's sort of narcissistic, as look at me, look at what I'm doing, instead of actually caring for, you know, women who are real victims of violence.
Okay, Genevieve, I want to ask you about another area that you've been writing about. Again, another issue that is not fun, as you say, and which involves a lot of work on the part of you and your team at Redux. This is the issue of the, and it really raises broader questions, I think, about where the trans ideology might be going. But this is the issue of the Norwegian pro-trans sexologist who, it's been discovered, had previously lobbied for essentially a pro-paedophile group, a group that talks about the rights of paedophiles or the importance of respect for people of the paedophilic tendency, as they might understand it. Could you tell us a bit more about this case? It's another shocking case that you have covered at your magazine. Not many other people have covered it. So could you tell us a little bit more about it?
Sure. And I just want to say thank you for bringing this up in the first place, because a few months after we published it, we got an email from Google telling us that this particular article was going to be censored in certain parts of Europe. They didn't say where or how exactly, but I guess in Google searches somewhere in some European country, you won't be able to find this article, is what I'm told. So this article is about Tore Longfelt is his name, and he has connections to the World Professional Association for Transgender Health now. But during the 70s and 80s, he was lobbying extensively for pedophilic relationships with children. He had claimed that children can understand their sexuality from the age of 2. And he also was working with a pedophile organization, a Norwegian pedophile organization called NAFP, or the Pedophile Working Group, I think it was called. So he was a known member of that group and has been even photographed and interviewed discussing normalizing pedophilia during that time period, all of which I've documented in the article I'm discussing. So that there are archival newspaper clippings that are involved in putting this together. But the curious thing is that the NAFP, or the Norwegian Pedophile Group, was established at the University of Oslo at the very same time where he was specializing in psychology, and himself and a mysterious other person who was supposed to be the founder of that organization, interestingly using the name lecturer E, as in like a professor, or you could think of it as a wordplay for Mr. E, mystery. The two of them, supposing that they're actually two people and not the same person, the two of them wrote to the Ministry of Justice in 1975 requesting to lower the legal age of consent to 14 years old. And then, so he's doing all this activism during the 70s and 80s. He's a sexologist and psychologist. He has, in several cases, at least two that I'm aware of, defended dangerous pedophiles in court on the basis of his expertise. But he also organized a very interesting, at least to me, historically interesting WPATH conference in Oslo, Norway in 2009, which dealt with the topic of transgender children. I've written about this conference before in its relation to a another story that I wrote, I suppose we might get into later, that involved a fetish forum and their involvement in that 2009 WPATH conference. But he's also been the president of the Harry Benjamin Resource Center in Europe, and he's also worked with, as with WPATH, he actually presented at that conference. He presented on the topic of the child in the discourse of transsexualism. And you have to wonder, again, your earlier point, if your belief system is emboldening people like this and actually involving people like this, you really need to question what is going on here and what is the motivation or the adverse outcome of it.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
If you're a regular listener to this show or a regular reader of Spiked, why not become a Spiked supporter? Spiked Supporters is our thriving community of people who donate to Spiked. Anyone who gives £5 or more a month or £50 or more a year can become a Spiked supporter and get access to lots of exciting perks. Spiked supporters can comment on articles, get free and discounted tickets to events, and bookmark articles as you browse. This is our way of saying thank you to all of you who fund our work. Spiked is completely free, and yet you still hand over your hard-earned cash to make sure that anyone, anywhere can read us and listen to us. We're incredibly grateful for your generosity. If you don't give to Spiked yet, now is the perfect time to start. Just go to spiked-online.com/supporters to set up your donation and your Spiked supporters account. That's spiked-online.com/supporters.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn. But hurry, these offers won't last forever. Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.
So, Genevieve, the case of the Norwegian sexologist is grimly interesting for the reasons you've just outlined. And I did want to ask you about, you've pointed to this in your pieces and in the work that you've been doing over the past few years, but I just want to ask you what you think the relationship is between the trans ideology and, I don't quite know how to put it, I guess one could just say paedophilia, but it's more than that. It's a kind of interest in children's bodies or in the sexual nature of children, which is how some of these activists would describe it. There is a crossover. I mean, I don't want to mention any names, but there have been other incidents where people who work at trans charities or who have made the trans case have ended up being people who've have an unhealthy interest in children and how children think and behave sexually as these people would understand it. What is the relationship there? How do you explain the fact that there is certainly a layer of trans activism or an element of trans activism that has this interest in children?
For me, having seen so many of these cases, it's beyond question for myself at this point, but trying to get people to understand it, I would say is that first they have to recognize that within, I would probably put it at a majority of the men who claim to be women, is a fetishistic element. And anyone who understands the escalating nature of pornography, for example, how one can become desensitized to certain content, sexual content, and then escalate to more dangerous or violent extremes in order to elicit the same thrill, you could then apply that to fetishism as well. So, in one regard, pornography has the potential to cause erectile dysfunction or impotence without the presence of the certain elements involved within the pornography that one's consuming. So in order to maintain that sexual thrill, it then needs to escalate. As I described with sissy porn, for example, men encouraging each other to go out into public, to perform certain tasks, sexual tasks in public and so on, then you could also see how that might lead towards pedophilia as a form of sadomasochism, as a sexual paraphilia, as all paraphilias are. They're involved with sadomasochism, such as pain or humiliation, or involved with objects or non-living things. Now, in the case of pedophilia in particular, there is something to this whole movement, the gender identity movement, where there seems to be something that looks like age regression involved in it. Like, as if men wanting to become women is actually really about maybe trying to look younger or stay sexy, or in some cases even identify as girls or children themselves. And I find that to be quite disturbing, but it's also incorporated within transgender pornography. So I know it's not just in my head. I've actually seen stories that they've written and content that they've made that involved the sexualization of children and the forcible transitioning of children as a sexual fetish. And I know for a fact that this content was made by men who in some cases identified as trans women themselves. So I would say there's the escalation aspect, but then there's also something involved with age regression, or perhaps a fear of aging that then becomes a part of this paraphilia and develops into pedophilia.
Yeah, that's a really interesting observation. And I often think about the puberty blocking question, because I have so many issues with the entire idea, and certainly with the practice of preventing a child's puberty stalling it, freezing it, giving them drugs to prevent the natural progression that occurs when a child is entering adulthood. It's a very strange phenomenon, but it's always struck me as particularly curious that it's essentially a campaign to keep children almost in a pubescent state or a pre-pubescent state, so that they don't actually make that, you know, confusing hormonal leap into adulthood that everyone ought to make. Do you see that as being part of this paraphilia, as part of this issue where, I mean, it certainly raises questions, doesn't it, that you can have this form of activism, and it's an increasingly mainstream form of activism that focuses so much of its attention on children, so-called trans children, and the right of society to prevent those children from going through puberty at the time that they ought to go through it?
I'd like to say a few things about that, and I'll start with the so men who claim to be women who alter their bodies, let's say, or engaging in a form of body modification as a fetish, many of them tend to have this overlapping castration fetish, which is not just like, I think people think of it as gender dysphoria. They might think that everyone who undergoes surgery must be really suffering terribly or have a really hard time, and it's very sympathetic and relatable. But actually, there's a significant amount of content online that depicts castration as a fetish. And it starts from BDSM and sadomasochism. So forms of BDSM that involve like female domination and humiliation and genital torture are easily available online. And again, communities form around this topic. So the genital mutilation itself as a form of a fetish is something that I have written extensively about, and documented even court cases about this. And so I think that some of these motivations that were just taken for granted as this is a dysphoria, this is a person who needs treatment or is suffering, I think plays into the hands of people who have very, very severely twisted intentions. I'd also like to say that the drugs that we call puberty blockers were not developed for this purpose at all. In fact, they're the same drugs, at least in the United States. Lupron or Luprolide is given to chemically castrate pedophiles or child sexual abusers. And the worst types, it's reserved for the worst types of sex offenders. So this treatment itself was developed by John Money, the man who pioneered the research behind gender identity. He was himself a sexologist who was involved in sex offender rehabilitation therapy. And so this drug that was meant to be chemically castrating pedophiles now is being given away to children, to castrate children. And I've even visited some forums where pedophile activists gather and seen them discussing the benefits of puberty blockers amongst themselves. And as well, Hannah Barnes, who had written her book, Time to Think, on this issue, discovered in her work that of the children who were being referred to the Tavistock Gender Identity Clinic, they were 10 times more likely to have a sex offender as a parent.
Yeah, it's... I mean, it is extraordinary when you lay it out in that way, as you've done in your writing as well. And I did, on this question, it's a difficult topic to talk about in some ways, but I did want to ask you about WPATH, which you've already mentioned. So this is the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, which puts forward the standards, I guess, or the ideas behind trans health, so-called trans health. There have been numerous controversies swirling around WPATH recently. We saw the WPATH files that were released online by journalists in the US, but you've been writing about the problems associated with WPATH for a long time, and in particular in relation to the connections between certain professionals around WPATH and the issues you've just been talking about, child abuse fetishism, child fetishism more broadly. Could you just explain a little bit about what WPATH, the links between WPATH and some of these incredibly concerning issues?
So a few years ago, WPATH, or the World Professional Association for Transgender Health, released their updated standards of care document, or the SOC8. And within those guidelines, I recognized a website that I had been looking at myself. It was called the UNIC Archive. And this is an online forum with anonymized members who participate in writing and sharing erotic fiction related to genital mutilation, torture, and even pedophilia. WPATH cited that forum in their guidelines, but they had also been working with them for over a decade, as I discovered when I looked into this, because certain academics who were involved in this forum were invited to speak at WPATH conferences and were having the opinions of these anonymous site members used in research that was being published by WPATH itself. And it was basically advocating for castration as a lifestyle and as an identity. So within the new guidelines, the SOC8, they were calling it a eunuch gender identity. I think this should raise alarm bells for a lot of people, and it wasn't widely picked up. It wasn't in the mainstream media, the work that I did, but it has been cited recently in a Supreme Court case that's going ahead in Alabama by the Attorney General of Alabama State against the transitioning of minors in order to show the questioning of WPATH's authority, let's say, on this issue, because WPATH has called for the removal of all objective age restrictions on the practice of medically transitioning children, allowing doctors to use their own judgment to determine procedures going forward, such as puberty blockers or even surgery itself. So knowing that these men, because because they are men, the members of this castration forum dealt primarily with male castration, as you could imagine. They were involved in influencing terminology that was found in diagnostic literature, if I'm to believe their own statements. So they were lobbying the APA, or the American Psychiatric Association, around terminology that involved body dysmorphia, gender dysphoria, and so on. In the past, in the last, I think it was 20 years ago, we had the term gender identity disorder, which was recognized as a mental disorder within diagnostic literature. But if I'm to believe what I read in this forum, these men were actually lobbying to have that changed to gender dysphoria. First, gender incongruence, and then softened to gender dysphoria. Of course, the problem with this is that that shift in terminology that happened in the DSM around 2010, 2011, something like this, that shift in language caused a spike in children being diagnosed with gender dysphoria, which then caused a spike in children actually being chemically castrated with puberty blockers.
It is extraordinary. And the work that you've done in exposing WPATH and some of the links it has, including to UNUC forums, I mean, that's a red flag to end all red flags. If you're citing or referring to a forum in which men discuss their fetish for castration, then there's a problem there. There's a very serious problem. And yet WPATH is treated very seriously by numerous medical bodies around the world. Following on from that, I did want to ask you about the more mainstream belief in such a thing as a trans child and the more mainstream willingness to assist children, or to, I guess, impose on children is the better way to describe it, certain forms of medical intervention or even social intervention to let them become the gender they supposedly are. How do you explain that more mainstream expression of these ideas? I think this is similar to a question I asked you last time, because I find your work on the porn question very interesting and very convincing. But then it raises in my mind a question of why Keir Starmer, for example, for years could not say what a woman was, and said that some women have penises and some women don't have penises, and really tied himself in knots on this fundamental question of truth. Now, I have no idea what Keir Starmer watches on his laptop late at night, but I'm going to give him the benefit of the doubt and say that he's not looking at sissy porn or anything like that. And yet he and other leading members of society buy into this stuff. They buy into this trans ideology. So in relation to the child issue in particular, you've described in great detail in your work and in this discussion how there are fetishists out there who are pushing this agenda, and they're often doing it through the so-called trans question. But then how do you explain, like, schools giving girls advice on how to bind their breasts, or schools allowing 13-year-old boys to go into the girls' changing rooms? What do you think explains the way in which the idea of the trans child has conquered so many mainstream institutions?
Well, if I could be a little vague at first, I think that the camera plays a lot in this. The fact that we're always being watched, or that we're watching each other, or that we might be recorded at any moment, is possibly altering people's behavior into a more performative type of interaction with each other. So there's a great deal of fear involved in stepping out of line. If you feel that you're always being watched, you might start to, I don't know, go along with the flow a little bit more than you might have previously. It becomes harder to speak out against popular issues. As well, there are people who are, just to put it frankly, mentally ill, who are pushing this issue because it's something that they've taken up for themselves. Some people have discussed what they have termed trans housing by proxy, which is the case of, let's say, like a parent wanting their child to be trans for the social clout that it might give them, for instance. So there's all these different reasons, but they all tend to resemble the worst social contagion we may have ever seen in human history, aided by our own technology that allows us to communicate with each other. I would say that the fetish aspect is one aspect that is also a social contagion. I would also say that groomers don't just groom children, they groom society. And there has never been a better tool for grooming society than we have right now through social media.
Okay, right. Genevieve, my final question for you is in relation to where you think things might go next. I think the really valuable thing about the work that you do and the work that Redux does is that it's a powerful reminder that there's more to this issue than the toilet question. You know, the kind of people who, the people who mock gender critical feminists or sex realists or however we want to describe people who understand that biology exists and that women and children deserve to be protected from dangerous ideologies. They will often say, oh, you're so obsessed about where people go to the toilet. You're obsessed with trifling issues. Now, my personal view is that men should not go into women's bathrooms under any circumstances. But the it's so much bigger than that. And that's really what your work points to, that this really does touch on the safety of women if they find themselves in the prison system, the safety of women in rape crisis centres, the right of children to live freely without being interfered with by the medical industrial complex and its the influences of suspect men on the internet who have found a way to push this issue in a certain direction. So it really does point to those far larger questions of safety, dignity, privacy, and freedom. And I just want to ask you how you think that discussion will go. So we started off saying that people have really seen the sports question as a flashpoint issue. You think that possibly prisons might become a flashpoint issue soon. It certainly deserves to. Do you think there will be more such flashpoints and eventually people will start to call into question the entire ideology itself?
I'm hopeful about some of the court cases that are going on in the United States, especially in regards to the transitioning of children. I think that this will become the next big fight to challenge the authority of WPATH, which has been taken as a leader internationally, worldwide. The standards that they set for this issue, especially for the transitioning of children, are incorporated throughout the world in places where it's going on. So I think that's the next big issue, or it ought to be, and seeing it being taken up by the Supreme Court in the United States does give me some hope. So following that, once we take up the issue of medically abusing children through gender ideology, I would like to see more discussion of the way in which this belief system can encourage violence against women. It would be nice for leaders to realize that, no, this isn't just both sides' issue, that people who have been talking about this have been threatened terribly. I mean, just at Redux, for example, we received threats from a convicted child killer after he was released from prison. He got a social media account and began threatening us with images of meat in a grinder and so on. So whenever we can get to a point to have a civilized discussion on this issue, I think it would be a relief to many people who have been discussing it to have some recognition of the what amounts to political terrorism being leveraged against them for the past decade.
Genevieve, thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to The Brendan O'Neill Show. We'll be back with another guest and more discussion. Don't forget to subscribe. And in the meantime, keep reading Spiked at www.spiked-online.com.
The Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall is turning up the heat this summer. Buy now with no down payment and no payments for 120 days.
That means no payments until fall. No payments until fall.
With over 8,000 cars, trucks, and SUVs available, there's something for every budget and lifestyle. Pick your ride, get approved, and drive home today with nothing due until autumn.
But hurry, these offers won't last forever.
Visit Jeff Weiler Columbus Auto Mall and take advantage while selection is strong.